Hello and welcome to today's episode of The Quad Shot, where we help you down and digest the day's most pertinent cancer news. It's December 9th, 2019. Welcome to the Quadcast. First up, protect yourself. If you ever feel like you need a comprehensive source to fall back on when counseling a man on management options for early stage prostate cancer, the PROTECT trial is here for you. As a reminder, the PROTECT trial randomized approximately 1,500 men with localized PSA-detected prostate cancer to active monitoring, radical prostatectomy, or radiation therapy. The patients were fairly young at 50 to 69 years of age. They were mainly white, and two-thirds had low-risk disease. In fact, less than 10% of patients had a PSA over 10 or grade group 3 or higher disease. The original publication reported the intention to treat analysis, but there were some big problems there considering a large proportion of men either declined randomization altogether, which was 37% of those that were eligible, or they chose a different management than the one that they were assigned, 78% of those randomized. This report gives us long-term outcomes based on the actual treatment received for both the randomized and observed cohorts. Half the men who declined randomization chose active monitoring, and they plus those assigned to active monitoring were able to stay on active monitoring for a median of 7.5 years. By 10 years, the cumulative risk of moving from active monitoring to treatment was 45%, or approximately 5% per year. With active monitoring, many men were able to avoid the side effects of treatment for many years with a small but significant increase in the risk of metastasis and potentially higher but still minuscule chance of dying from prostate cancer. With radical prostatectomy or radiation, there was no difference in prostate cancer outcomes. By choosing surgery, there was a much higher risk of long-term incontinence at 30 to 40% and impotence at 85 to 90%. By choosing radiation, there was a higher short-term risk of nocturia at 65% and higher long-term risk of bloody stools at 5% and impotence at 60 to 70%, but this eventually converged with active monitoring by year 6. So what's the bottom line? Active monitoring in men with mostly low-risk prostate cancer can defer treatment for going on a decade at the cost of a slightly higher risk of cancer metastases, thanks to Neal et al.'s publication in European Urology, 2019. Up second, whodunit. High-risk meningioma is an uncommon but aggressive entity. So what exactly is high-risk meningioma anyway? Well, it's not exactly the same as high-grade meningioma. RTOG-0539 was a Phase 2 risk-adaptive trial looking at the safety and efficacy of different treatment regimens for different risk levels of meningioma. Quote-unquote high-risk was defined as any WHO grade 3 or any recurrent or new but subtotally resected WHO grade 2 meningioma, and just over half of the patients had WHO grade 2 meningioma, most of which were recurrent. Here we have published results in the Red Journal 2019 by Rogers et al., in which there were two clinical target volumes, a 2-centimeter expansion on gross tumor that received 1.8 gray times 30 fractions for a total of 54 gray, and a simultaneous integrated boost to a 1-centimeter expansion on gross tumor that received 2 gray times 30 fractions for a total of 60 gray. An important treatment planning note is that 40% of the plans required use of a modified planning target volume, typically another 3 to 5 millimeter margin, that received less than the prescribed dose due to overlap with the planning reference volume of an adjacent critical organ, usually the optics. The primary outcome of 3-year progression-free survival was 59%, which is somewhat disappointingly low. Interestingly, progression-free survival for recurrent grade 2 tumors was 45%, which was worse than that for new grade 3 tumors at 65%. These findings suggest that observation of high-risk meningioma, which is not uncommon, by the way, could lead to very poor treatment outcomes and compromise subsequent treatment efficacy. Over 90% of all progression events occurred within the 54 gray target volume, and almost all of these were near or within the 60 gray volume. The bottom line is, high-risk meningioma merits adjuvant radiation treatment, but we still have some detective work to do when it comes to optimizing treatment efficacy. Up next, I can see clearly now. Dense breasts have a higher proportion of opaque parenchymal tissue on mammogram, making abnormalities such as cancer more difficult to visualize. And the additional parenchyma is also associated with an increased risk of breast cancer. So what is dense breast tissue anyway? Well, BI-RADS has a 4-point scale where C is heterogeneously dense and D is extremely dense, to the point that it obscures mammography. It's this latter category that may benefit from supplemental screening such as breast MRI. The DENSE trial included over 40,000 women aged 50 to 75 in the Dutch mammography screening program who had extremely dense breast tissue. They were randomized 1-4 to have a supplemental MRI or routine screening. Though, just over half randomized to MRI actually had the MRI. The incremental cancer detection rate with supplemental MRI was 16.5 per 1,000 screenings, while the false positive rate was 8%, or 80 per 1,000 screenings. Put another way, among the women who had a biopsy after MRI, only a quarter actually had cancer. But in the interval between the initial and subsequent mammogram 2 years later, supplemental MRI screening significantly lowered the risk of subsequent breast cancer diagnosis from 5 to 2.5 cancers per 1,000 screenings. Now, this is the initial report after the initial round of biennial screening, and mostly small breast cancers were detected. It remains to be seen whether this strategy can reduce the rate of more advanced breast cancer. The bottom line is, supplemental breast MRI after negative mammogram for women with extremely dense breast tissue halves the rate of breast cancer that develops in the interval between biennial mammogram. Up next, outside the five. The Australian Gastrointestinal Trials Group and the Trans-Tasman Radiation Oncology Group have published their guidelines for pancreas SBRT. This is complete with a step-by-step contouring how-to and detailed dose constraints. They are well thought out and generated with international expert input to guide their pancreas SBRT clinical trial. But while you're reading, try to think outside the five fractions, that is. We've become a little brainwashed into thinking that quote-unquote ablative radiation must fit into five fractions or less, not in small part due to arbitrary billing rules. If you're dropping down into the 25 gray range with your five fraction dose, perhaps it's time you consider alternative ablative fractionation schemes. The bottom line is, Trans-Tasman guidelines recommend 8 gray times 5 for a total of 40 gray during deep inspiration breath hold for pancreas SBRT. Thanks to OR, Practical Radiation Oncology, 2019. Up next, leptomaniacs. Post-op brain radiosurgery to minimize leptomeningeal disease is apparently quite the hot topic. Here we have one of the largest series yet. This time, it's from Stanford. It includes 442 patients treated with CyberKnife SRS for over 500 resected brain metastases. Most patients, greater than 75%, were treated with 8 gray times 3, and most using a 1 to 3 millimeter margin around the cavity. At 12 months, the rate of leptomeningeal disease was 13% overall, and they used recent consensus definitions of nodular and classic LMD, and just over half of the LMD recurrences were nodular. LMD, or leptomeningeal disease, was highest at about 20% for those with breast histology and or an infratentorial tumor location. The cumulative local failure rate was only 7%, and the distant intracranial failure rate was 37%. The bottom line is, this large series by Shi et al. In the Red Journal 2019 confirms an overall low rate of leptomeningeal disease recurrence and favorable rates of local control with post-op radiosurgery for resected brain metastases. Up next, get after it. Anaplastic thyroid cancer is a disease where radiation oncologists can really hang their hats on the whole local control thing. And that's because unharnessed local tumor progression is a major cause of cancer-related morbidity and mortality. This retrospective analysis by Fan et al., published in Cancer 2019, of over 100 patients treated at Memorial Sloan Kettering, indicates that radiation doses greater than or equal to 60 gray improve not only local control, but also overall survival, supporting more aggressive radiation regimens as a crucial component of any trimodal treatment regimen. Up next, peer pressure. What's the best way to introduce more hypofractionated radiation regimens into widespread use? Well, introduce a little peer pressure. In this study published by you in Practical Radiation Oncology 2019, having a rad onc who utilized hypofractionation for breast cancer within a peer group of rad oncs increased the likelihood that hypofractionation was used in subsequent years. In contrast, peer groups that didn't use hypofractionation weren't likely to start using it over time. Interestingly, this didn't hold true for using shorter course treatment for bone metastases. The bottom line is, be careful of who you surround yourself with, because you very well may adopt their treatment habits. Up next, a calculated risk. Veterans are a particularly vulnerable population living amidst the opioid crisis. This retrospective look in JNCI 2019 by Witzlem et al. Evaluated over 100,000 U.S. veteran cancer survivors, and it reveals predictors of opioid abuse that persist long after active cancer treatment comes to an end. Risk factors include being young, being white, being unemployed, being poor, being depressed, and receiving chemotherapy, along with being a user of other drugs. Fortunately, these authors developed an easy-to-use calculator that can help quantify the potential need for opioid abuse risk mitigation. Check it out at canceropioidrisk.org. Up next, trim the fat. Multiple studies have demonstrated worse breast cancer outcomes with increasing BMI. This study, published in JAMA Oncology 2019 by Feliciano, takes the bold step of explaining why. Using CT scans to quantify body composition with Hounsfield units, they show that greater adiposity was associated with receiving less than 85% of the planned dose of chemotherapy, which may in turn explain some of the discrepancy in survival outcomes. Finally, what's that? Researchers at WashU have developed an effective model to predict hearing loss after radiation plus or minus cisplatin chemotherapy for head and neck cancer, and it's based exclusively on pretreatment data points. Take a closer look at the model in the JAMA Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery 2019 publication by Shute et al. This concludes today's episode of The Quad Shot. If you like what you've heard, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and subscribing to our podcast. Also, check out our website at www.quadshotnews.com and subscribe to our newsletter. We'll catch you next time.